Thank you so much, and good warriors, welcome. For those of you who have honored us by attending, we will channel all of our Bay Area sports energy to Cleveland, and go Steph and go Clay. Thanks to Norma and the International Forum Committee for hosting us, and it's an honor to be here at the club again. As we commemorate the centennial of the Panama Pacific International Exposition, which many of you know we've shorthanded to PPIE 100, so we didn't have to keep on saying Panama Pacific International Exposition Centenary, we welcome you as we think about the commemoration, the celebration, the problematization of the World's Fair of 1915, audaciously and imperiously planned just after the uppity United States took over the somewhat troubled experimental dream of creating a connection between the two worlds of the Atlantic and the Pacific. I'm honored tonight to introduce three distinguished panelists and historians who will help us both understand, I think, the important legacy of the isthmus, the moment of the canal's opening in 1914, and what the next century might hold as we look towards the future. I think many of you have been with us since the February 20th opening of the World's Fair Centenary of the PPI 100, so welcome back. And for those of you who haven't, we're working with about 50-plus organizations and institutions around the Bay Area and the world to commemorate the World's Fair, and you can check it all out on ppia100.org. And my deep thanks to my colleague, Adam Hirschfelder, who's managing that project with great aplomb. If we think about that narrow passage connecting the two great bodies of water that we know as the Atlantic and the Pacific, think back to a time long ago when it was probably the first home of the earliest pottery making that we ever saw in the Americas, from about 2500 to 1700 BC. The populations that grew there in that incredibly dense, remarkable place grew to anywhere between 250,000 to almost perhaps 2 million in terms of estimates before contact. They were known for spectacular, complicated burial rituals and was widely settled before the first Europeans came in the very early part of the 16th century. So the Panama we know is a complicated mixture of a very layered past, which I think some of my great panelists might get to, and was in a way it's, as we celebrated in 1915, as we continue to celebrate today, kind of thoughts of how the Americas connect and how we connect with the rest of the Pacific world and the Pacific Rim and Asia and Southeast Asia. That part of the world, that little teeny isthmus, has always been a center of trade and commerce, of interaction of peoples, of ideas, and of objects. And I'm not going to steal anyone's thunder, especially the man I get to introduce first, who has reached out to us very early on as we started the project. To him we owe a great nod of gratitude. Gene Bigler is a consultant and a writer, graduated from the University of Pacific and Johns Hopkins University. Was a Fulbright scholar, an amazing career as both a counselor, both of the economic and political affairs at the embassy in Panama, so he has direct Panamanian experience. My favorite title that I will never glean, because he already has it, it was the Chief Canal Watcher after, I know, exactly. That's so cool. A CEO is nothing compared to Chief Canal Watcher. After the transfer of Panama and helped develop a series of new agreements with Panama for the United States. And he continues to maintain very close relations with the Panama Canal Authority, and I so look forward to his bringing his great depth of experience, especially in the Foreign Service, to our time. And he thank God, still lives in California, in Stockton, it's great to see you, sir. He's joined by Dr. Herman Boshkin, who earned degrees both from that small university that Phoebe Hearst helped establish over across the bay at University of California, Berkeley, and at the University of Washington. His range of scholarly and intellectual pursuits has taken him through many, I think, a research library and practical experience as his articles and books focus on globalization, urban public policy, and not surprisingly, if you've had a chance to read any of them or glance at any of them, he's won awards for them. I think some of his most interesting work revolves around what he's called the container revolution, which traces the utter transformation of how we ship our goods around the world. And you don't have to look far to any port, especially the major Pacific ports that we're honored and to have in California to see that. He's been on the faculty of University of Southern California, at Berkeley, at Davis, at San Jose State, and has spent both extensive stints in Sweden and Canada on Fulbrights. And it's an honor to have you here, sir. Last but certainly not least is Dr. Michael Conniff. There's another Berkeley. You guys have some, you know, some Cal grads for the UCLA Bruin, you know, go Bears, right. As well as at Stanford. And his work has also focused extensively on Panama and its relationship with the United States, as well as its broader contextual relationship with Latin America. Importantly, and I think his work and others have helped us understand that from the start of contact, that the Americas, especially Central and Latin America, but all through the Americas, including California, has been a very diverse place. His work on Africans and the Americas was seminal. It's about 12 years old now, but still helps us understand the complicated global colonialization patterns and movement of peoples. He's probably the hippest of all of us because he also served in the Peace Corps, and he might actually slip into Portuguese and Spanish, which he also knows and lectures in. Swears in or something else, you know, exciting. He's had a remarkable academic career as well, and most recently he spent spring in Florida, which sounds lovely, as the Bacardi Eminent Professor of Latin American Studies at the University of Florida. And so we're honored to have all three gentlemen with us tonight, and without any further ado, I will step down and turn it over to them. So my thanks again to all of you, to the Commonwealth Club, and to my distinguished panelists. And I look forward to the questions.
Thank you very much, Althea. She's taller than I am, so I'm going to have to adjust this down. And let me get my clicker here. Which one of the buttons?
The one on the right.
The one on the right? No, okay. Good evening. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm very happy to be talking about Panama. It's a country that I first set foot in 50 years ago. I traveled all the way through Mexico and Central America, landed in Panama, and ended up working for the foreign policy people there, foreign development people. And since that time, I've been back a number of times. I've written several books about Panama, and now I'm happy to say that Gene Bigler, who's at the far end of the table there, he and I are going to do a book called Panama Since 1980. So it's going to be a contemporary study of Panama. Last year, in Spanish we say el gordo y el flaco, the big guy and the little guy. There's the United States on the left, and the flaco of Panama on the left side and on the right hand side. And as Althea said, there's a lot of disproportion in there. Panama is a very small place, and the United States is a very large country. But for almost 100 years, those two countries had to get along together. The United States helped Panama become independent in 1903, And then Teddy Roosevelt pretty much forced the Panamanians to accept a treaty with the United States, whereby the United States would build a canal connecting the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. The Panamanians didn't really have much choice about that. It was a joining together of two nations, Panama recently independent, and the United States already 150 years old. Two countries joined together for the purpose of creating a ship canal and operating that canal through most of the 20th century. I call this the Forced Alliance because Panama didn't really have much voice in that. They had to go along with Teddy Roosevelt because his threat to them was, if you don't go along with the treaty that I'm proposing to you, I'm going to let the Colombians come back and take you back. The Panamanians had declared their independence from Panama. This is what we commemorated last year, the 100th anniversary of the first ship to go through the Panama Canal in 1914. This was a workboat, the Ancon, and it went through the canal. The canal was, we celebrated the centenary last year. We celebrated that, and then we recognized it in the PPA 100. Thanks for that shorthand. But the canal didn't really open immediately for business because World War I occurred, and we couldn't open up the ship canal to enemy ships, and what's more, the canal ran into some security problems and also some landslides. So it didn't really open for good until 1920. But that's what we're commemorating these years. Here's a cartoon that I hope you can sort of figure it out. I'll try to walk you through it. Teddy Roosevelt on the right, larger than life. And the conspirator over on the left is a Frenchman, French engineer by the name of Bruno Varilla. And Teddy Roosevelt and Bruno Varilla got together, and they cooked up a deal whereby the United States would buy from the French company that had been working on building a canal there, buy from the French company for $400 million, which is a bunch of money in those days, the rights to build a canal in Panama. And the Panamanians were simply going to go along with that. What they're conspiring to do is Bruno Varilla is lighting a candle underneath this egg in Colombia and trying to get it to hatch. And Colombia hatches, and the little baby chick comes out, and that's the Republic of Panama, born at that moment in 1903. And this then allowed Teddy Roosevelt to have his way getting a treaty in 1903. And actually, I refer to this as a tale of two treaties, the 1903 treaty and the 1977 treaty that pretty much began the ending of our relationship with Panama. So I'm going to be going over in my 15 minutes or so the 85 years that the United States operated the Panama Canal pretty much on our own. And then after the 1977 treaty signed by Jimmy Carter and by Omar Torrijos, the Panamanian president, then there another 20-year period occurred in which the United States began gradually to pass off the operation, the management of the canal to the Panamanians, and eventually walked away from it in 1999. That was the end of that, the end of the long transition. A question arises in all of this is whose canal was it? Of course, Teddy Roosevelt said it was ours. He said, I took it. Fair and square, and many politicians throughout the 20th century have said it was our canal. But in fact, if you look back at the treaty language, it said the United States will build and operate a canal as if it were sovereign in the territory of Panama. As if. And that grammatically suggests that we weren't really fully sovereign there. But that was sort of a fine point, a grammatical point back in those days, and nobody, Teddy Roosevelt certainly was not going to quibble over whether he was sovereign or not. He was sovereign. He simply took it and ran with it. And throughout much of the 20th century, that was the U.S. interpretation. It was ours. We bought it, we built it, we own it, and we're never going to give it away. But the Panamanians thought, well, wait a minute, this is right in the middle of our country. The country is spread out about 500 miles in either direction from the canal. The canal splits the country right in two. And for much of the 20th century, Panamanians could not freely go from one part of their country to the other. And it so happened that canal zone was right next to the two main cities in Panama. So it created a real difficulty for the Panamanians to get along with, live with the Americans in the canal zone. The Panamanians first protested, and then they began to try to work out an arrangement with the United States. And it was really the next fellow I'm going to put on the slide, a man named Belisario Porras. He was president of Panama from 1912 to about 1924. And he, I regard as the father of his nation. He was there at the time of the independence. He actually opposed the independence on the grounds that if Panama became independent at that time under the aegis of the United States, that it would be an unequal relationship, and he's absolutely right. That's exactly what happened. But then he came back and won election in 1912, and he was the man who established a relationship with the U.S. government. It was now Woodrow Wilson in the presidency, U.S. presidency, and who established a long list of demands and requests that the Panamanians made of the United States so that they could have jobs, good jobs, in the canal, so that they could sell goods to the canal zone, sell goods to the ships going through the canal, so that they would have benefit from the business taking place in the Panama Canal. They didn't want the canal to be hermetically sealed away from the economy and the society of Panamanians. They wanted to be part of that growing business of the Panama Canal. So that was sort of the core request or demand on the part of Panamanians through much of the 20th century. They wanted to simply get a good deal to work with the canal and prosper by the existence of the Panama Canal. So this president, Belisario Porras, filed a number of requests to the State Department and to the White House, requesting that these things happen. They pretty much never did. One of his foreign secretaries said, "It's sort of, you know, Panama getting along with the United States is sort of like when you hit an egg with a rock. You see, you know what happens? The egg breaks." He said, "But turn it around, look at it the other way." He said, "What happens if you hit a rock with an egg? Same thing, the egg breaks." So he said, essentially, Panama was always going to be on the losing end of whatever demands they posited the United States. And that pretty much was the case for much of the 20th century. Now, from time to time, the White House and the State Department would sit down with the Panamanians and say, "Well, let's see what we can do. Let's try to make this a better arrangement for you." In 1926, they allowed more trade between the canal zone where the canal was operating and the society and the economy of Panama. But it was so lopsided, so favorable to the United States and so unfavorable to the Panamanians, that the Panamanian legislature actually rejected the deal. They said, "We're not going to sign that treaty in terms that are as onerous as those are to our nation. You know, we're trying to create their own nation, trying to establish the basis for prosperity." Later, another president, this is Armolio Arias, became president in 1932, at the time that Franklin Roosevelt, just a little before Franklin Roosevelt became president. And when Roosevelt, second Roosevelt, announced the good neighbor policy, this man said, "Well, good neighbor, that's what we've been looking for all this time. Let's go up to Washington and see if we can't talk some good neighbor with Franklin Roosevelt." So he did. And Franklin Roosevelt was really kind of changing the overall policy of the United States toward Latin America as a whole. And he said, "Yeah, that's reasonable. We'll work on that." He instructed Secretary of State Hull to work with this man and his foreign secretary, and they came up with a treaty in 1936. And it went further than what had happened before. It said that Panamanians would have the right to good jobs in the canal. That's a reasonable sort of thing. Panamanians will be able to sell goods to the canal zone as they're needed. The canal zone will not be able to compete with businesses in Panama because they had industries and whole factories set up in the canal zone the canal zone was practically self-sufficient. But the Panamanians said, "No, you know, we're a country. We want to sell to our people. We want to develop our industry." So President Roosevelt agreed with that. The treaty was signed in 1936. But it turned out that the U.S. Senate didn't want to approve it. They said, "Well, we don't want to give this away. That's giving things to the Panamanians, and they don't deserve it. You know, we built the canal; it's ours." But in 1939, with the onset of World War II, this meeting was held in Panama. It was the foreign ministers of all of the Americas, from Argentina all the way to Canada, and the United States was very anxious to have the nations of the Americas, 1939, get together and decide on common defensive posture for dealing with the war in Europe. So, and Panama said, well, we'll be happy to host that meeting. And then Roosevelt said to Congress, said to the Senate, it's very awkward for us. You haven't approved that 1936 treaty, and we're hosting a meeting of the foreign ministers, so the Senate hurriedly approved that treaty. So that was a step toward Panama getting a more equitable share in the business of the canal. World War II changed the relationship between the United States and Panama very, very deeply. First of all, defense issues arose. The canal was vulnerable to attacks by both Japan and by Germany. So we beefed up our defenses there. I've got a shot of an anti-aircraft. There were about 50 of these anti-aircraft sites around the canal to protect it from an air attack. And also, the Navy, which was building ships too large to go through the Panama Canal, the Navy said, well, we need a larger canal. We need to get, you know, really dig something deep so we get our aircraft carriers and our destroyers through there. So they began a project 1939 to 1942 to build a new, wider canal. It turned out that by 1942 they could see they wouldn't finish the wide canal by the end of the war. But I'm happy to say that the Panamanians are widening a canal right now, and they're using some of that excavation from World War II. So it's kind of history coming around to right the wrongs. After World War II, the War Department, the Pentagon, and the Navy all said the Panama Canal is a nice little ship canal for taking goods back and forth the oceans, but it's not a strategic asset for us, for the military. We can't defend it. We've got nuclear weapons out there. There's no way in the world we could stop it. We probably couldn't have stopped concerted air attacks on the Panama Canal. So they downgraded the military importance of the Panama Canal, and so it went from becoming from being one of the premier outposts of American military presence to being simply a ship canal. Now, it was not that the Pentagon simply walked away from the canal zone and said, we're not going to use it anymore, and so we're going to abandon it. In fact, they beefed it up, and they built 14 different military bases in Panama, not to protect the canal, and not because it would be defensible against nuclear weapons and concerted attacks, but because it was a forward base in the southern hemisphere. So all of these military bases there were really relevant to the canal. The canal was moving ships through, but these were military bases that were projecting American power clear into the southern hemisphere, Africa, South America, and the Pacific. So that's why the canal zone was so important, not as a canal, not as a ship canal, but as a military presence. After the war, State Department, the Pentagon and the State Department both went to Panama and said, you know, you gave us those all those anti-aircraft sites, 50 of them around the canal, and we'd like to keep those. You know, we're going to try to defend the canal. And the Panamanians stood up almost as a man and a woman and said no. They rejected the proposal that the United States had to continue to defend the canal with this kind of installation. These were way, way out beyond the canal zone. But the Panamanians said, no, enough is enough. It's beginning almost a refrain now that the United States is becoming too aggressive in demanding compliance from the United States, from Panama. That was called the rechazo, or the rejection. Now here, two more presidents in the 1950s, Eisenhower on the left and President Grimon on the right, two men get together, and again, Grimon actually flew up to Washington, sort of like Armando Arias had done. He knocks on the door of the White House and says, Señor Presidente, you must talk with me. We must do something to create an equitable situation for Panama. We simply can't go on the way we are. The country is poor. We're uneducated. We don't have the revenues we need to create a modern country here, and the canal is a way for us to do that. So Eisenhower said, well, that's a reasonable request. Let's sit down and negotiate. So they did. They negotiated a treaty in 1955. But it's almost now a sort of broken record. It's too little, too late. Because a year after the treaty between these two men, Colonel Nasser took over the Suez Canal in 1956. It just took it, just moved his troops in there. And when France and England were going to recapture it from Egypt, Eisenhower said, no, you can't do that. That's a vestige of colonialism. And the British and the French simply cannot move in imperialist fashion and take back the Suez Canal. Well, the Panamanians looked at Eisenhower and said, well, wait a minute, that's just described our canal, too. I mean, you're hanging on to it by military force. And so the Panamanians said, this treaty was too little, too late. And not only was that happening, but guerrilla warfare was beginning to bubble up in the Caribbean. Fidel Castro was starting his guerrilla movement in Cuba. So a lot of things were changing. The Panamanians simply said, this can't go on. We've got to reach an agreement with the United States here. And the turning point came on actually the 50th anniversary of the opening of the Panama Canal in 1964. President Eisenhower had said, we will allow some Panamanian flags to fly in the canal zone as a symbol of their sovereignty. That is, Eisenhower admitted that if the treaty said the United States will operate the canal as if it were sovereign, that means that ultimately Panama is the sovereign there. So someday in the future, you know, we'll give this back to Panama. But the students in the canal zone took down the Panamanian flag that Eisenhower had authorized to fly there, and Panamanian students went into the canal zone and rescued their flag, and they were going to raise it back up, and then there was a fight. And the fight led to police coming in, firing shots, and then eventually U.S. soldiers. So it was a four-day fight, struggle between these protesters and the canal zone authorities that left over two dozen people dead. So that was a turning point. When you have people dying, people willing to give up their lives for a cause that they believe in, that was simply something that the United States couldn't turn away from. And Lyndon Johnson, who had just become president a couple of months beforehand, said essentially the United States is too big a country to take advantage of a small country like this. So let's do away with that 1903 treaty, the one that is so iniquitous to the Panamanians, the original sin, and let's negotiate something new that the Panamanians can live with, that we can live with, that's going to protect our rights and protect our military interests there, and we'll move forward with that. Well, it wasn't that easy for either Lyndon Johnson or the four other presidents who followed him. They continued to negotiate for 10 years. Actually, it was 13 years, until finally Jimmy Carter finally said in his first year, this is time I can get this done, let's go ahead and write a treaty. So he and Panama's strongman, Omar Torrijos, wrote a treaty in 1919. Here are the students rescuing their flag, and that led to the melee of several days and many, many deaths. Well, here's the ceremony when Torrijos and Jimmy Carter signed the 1977 treaty. There were a lot of arguments in favor of it, but it was not a very popular treaty in the United States. You may remember that many members of Congress from the Senate had to approve it, were actually going to vote against it. There were many campaigns. And it was just barely squeaked by. Just by one vote, the Senate approved this. It was the most contentious Senate treaty approval since the Senate refused to approve the Versailles Treaty in 1920. So that gives you an idea of how serious this moment was. The treaty implementation began in 1978, the Congress passed the law implementing the treaty, and the treaty actually went into effect in the year later, 1979. So from 1979 until 1999, it was a 20-year period in which the treaty was implemented piece by piece. It was essentially an action to withdraw all of this great investment the United States had made in Panama, in the canal zone, and to do it in an orderly fashion, to train Panamanians to take over and manage it, to make sure that it was defended, to make sure it was maintained. And to my way of thinking, in all of the world history in the 20th century, all the times when imperial powers and colonial powers withdrew, say, England from Hong Kong, or many of the European countries after World War from the Middle East, I think this withdrawal of the United States from Panama was the most orderly and successful and satisfying for both the United States and for Panama. So I give a lot of credit to not only President Carter, but also the Americans who stayed in the Panama Canal and oversaw the implementation of that treaty and eventually the turnover of the canal in 1999. The first administrator, when the canal under the new treaty, the administrator of the canal was an army man. It was a general from the Corps of Engineers. And he took over, and he administered the canal for all of the 1980s. And then in the 1990s, several Panamanians became sort of CEO of the Panama Canal, again, as purposely to move forward with the taking over the canal, learning to manage it, learning to operate it, learning to protect it, and do all the things that have to do. If you have a very large, complicated piece of equipment, you need to maintain it well. The main problem we ran into with the implementation of the treaty, it was not as simple as it looked on paper, was this man here, Manuel Antonio Noriega, a strong man who took over when Torrijos, the fellow who signed that 77 treaty, when he died in a plane crash. Noriega became strong man in Panama, and he began fighting back against the United States. He was a very complex man and a very ruthless man. And it became almost impossible to do business with him. And I think there's a book out there called "Doing Business with a Dictator," but it was not easy. And it took an invasion of Panama in 1989. 24,000 troops landed in Panama in 1989 to capture him and take him to the United States for trial. In fact, Noriega is still in jail down in Panama today. Well, once that occurred in 1989-1990, the implementation of the treaty went back on track. That is, it went back to it was written in the treaty. And so the first Panamanian administrator of the canal took over. Then the canal began to focus on doing those maintenance kinds of things, the investment things, capital improvements that would make the canal operate well, efficiently, at the moment that the United States turned it over. So there's no point in turning over a broken canal to the Panamanians. So that was it was turned over. The investment took place. In fact, Gene is going to talk about that. And so I've taken the story through the 1990s with the Panamanians gearing up to take over the canal. And Gene is going to talk about what happened when they did. I just want to leave you with one little admonition. This is a political scientist with the American Enterprise Institute, Mark Falkoff. He published a book two years before Panama took over the canal. And the book was entitled, "What Happens When the United States Gives a Little Country What It Wants?" And it was a rhetorical question, obviously, but it implied that the Panamanians would not be able to run the canal, that they would break it. They wouldn't maintain it, that they would fall among themselves fighting over the spoils of the canal, and it would ruin the country, and the United States would lose its great assets of the Panama Canal. It was really a dire book of predictions that I'm going to let Gene talk about how the Panamanians, whether they broke it or not. Thank you very much.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you. We'll set this back right, Dr. Hartig. It's a pleasure to be here, and we're grateful to our hosts in the Commonwealth Club and our friends in the California Historical Society that we can be part of this centennial year of this close relationship between California and Panama. It's very important to me as a native Californian, and I've always, my fascination with our relationship with the canal goes back and is rooted in the importance of the canal for us in our relationship to Panama, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. As I was thinking about how to approach the subject, I decided that I wanted to see if I could distill my thinking about the transition from the last 100 years to the next 100 years. And I came up with the idea of talking about some crucial things that the Panamanians are doing with the canal that are at the heart of what they plan to do for the next 100 years. So I'm going to be talking about these 7 keys to Panama. And it's important to remember some of the things that Mike just mentioned. And I want to start off with the mention of Mark Falkoff and the fact that this great American scholar who I happened to get to know when I was a graduate student in Washington, D.C., and this dire prediction about what happens when a small country gets what they want. When I arrived in Panama just after the transition, and I'll come back, this was the transition ceremony that took place on December 31st, 1999, and Dr. Conniff was there with the official party and was part of the ceremony. One of the fascinating things about my arrival as a Foreign Service officer, I was the counselor for economic and political affairs, and I had been recruited because after the treaties expired, we no longer had a formal structural relationship with Panama, and we were going to be negotiating 4 new treaties with the Panamanians. And so I was recruited as a counselor for political and economic affairs to work in both of these areas. But I also had this other part of my experience, which Dr. Hartig mentioned. Informally, I was called the chief canal watcher for the U.S. government. Starting at that moment, and for the last 15 years, I've continued to watch very closely and come up with this idea about these 7 key practices that are guiding the trajectory of Panama in its administration of the canal, and as it moves forward into this century in trying to create a new logistics hub for the entire Western Hemisphere. And it's a different kind of a concept from the way the administration of the passageway was done by the United States. So I've kind of crystallized this into these 7 objectives that the Panamanians are pursuing in their administration of the canal. The first is the restoring of the tradition of engineering excellence, which came, of course, from the engineering marvel that the Panama Canal was when it was completed. One of the things that most of us actually don't realize is that over the 80-some years of U.S. administration, because especially after the Second World War, it was no longer so important to the United States for strategic reasons. In fact, the canal became very obsolete in many respects. I'll talk a little bit about that, but keeping that tradition of engineering excellence was very important to the Panamanians. A second part of their approach to administering the canal was very different from the way we administered the canal, and that is that the Panamanians saw the key to their taking advantage of their passageway between the seas as an opportunity to promote commercial corporate dynamism in their national territory, and to use this passageway as a means of creating an economic powerhouse in this Isthmian transit zone that is the core of the natural resources that Panama has. The third point is that in order to do this, they not only were going to have to build on the dynamism administration of the canal, they're going to have to build out the crossroads and add additional services that would make that crossroads productive for the world community. The fourth point is that in the process of doing this, they were going to try and take this American icon, the Panama Canal, and convert it into a national product, a national project that was meaningful to the people of Panama. The fifth point in their project is no sooner had we begun the transition in the late 1980s than it was widely recognized that the canal was increasingly inadequate for the world shipping industry that the Panamanians were going to encounter when they took control of the passageway. And so during the entire, the first 15 years especially, of the transition, one of the things were there were repeated studies about ways in which a new canal could be created. Some of you may remember one of the ideas was that we would even use nuclear devices in order to dig a canal across Panama. There were all of these schemes. There was a great three-nation project, the United States, Japan, and Panama, did a major study of another approach. All of that was part of the process before the Panamanians actually came up with an approach to the expansion that is going on and being completed right now. Finally, as they realized the complications of this new crossroads that they were creating, they realized there were a lot more things they had to add to it. And so they began to be concerned with these additional spokes they would add to the hub that they were trying to create in the center of the Americas. One of the things that they neglected all along the way, however, was the challenge of the institutional development that is needed to carry out their complex plan. So the last of those things that the Panamanians are concerned with is the way in which they can continue to develop the supporting institutions they need. So there is the transition moment, and the important point about the transition, as Dr. Conniff pointed out, was that, in fact, there was a good deal of cooperation between the United States and Panama as the transition process went forward in the 1980s and 1990s. Now, there was also some resistance on the American part, and especially on the part of the folks that were known as Zonians, the people that had a stake in living in the canal zone and had lived, and in fact, in this colonial enclave, and a really comfortable lifestyle. It was important for maintaining the canal, but they were a society of privilege, which contrasted to the backward and economically impoverished Panamanian society around them. So that was part of, created some of the difficulties, but there were also difficulties in what the United States wanted out of the canal. As Dr. Conniff mentioned, the most important thing to us was the use of the canal as a strategic forward base for projecting American power into the world. That was foremost in our concept of the canal. The ship channel and the use of the transit was also important to our use, but it actually was of secondary importance to us. And so even after the naval importance declined, we had taken an approach to the maritime use of the canal, which was based on the simple principle that we wanted the use of maritime transportation to underpin the entire U.S. economy and be an essential part of the economic integration of our great continental country. And in fact, the canal was incredibly important for that reason. The United States is the only continental country in the world that has low-cost, water-based transportation as an essential part of our economic integration. Dr. Boshkin is going to talk a lot more about the shipping and the strategic interests, but the United States was a bit short-sighted in the approach that we took, and so we had some policies that led us not to, to invest less in maintaining the canal and upgrading the canal and keeping it the technological wonder that it was when we built it. So when the Panamanians began to exercise the leadership over the transition, the first thing that they did to demonstrate their commitment to the excellence in engineering tradition was to insist that some fundamental upgrading of the engineering had to take place as part of the transition process. And not just the engineering either. There was also even the environmental engineering, because the United States had neglected the environmental impact of the canal zone, and the watershed had declined. There were actually, beginning in the 1980s, water shortages. There were periods of time in which the loads of ships had to be lightened because there wasn't enough water in the lake for the fully loaded transits. So as this transition period began to take place, the new standards of engineering excellence were undertaken. And I think one of the most interesting parts of this was the widening of the Culebra Cut. Culebra, of course, in Spanish means snake. And this long cut, an 8-mile passageway that goes through a mountain that rises over, it originally was over 450 feet, and they had to dig through this mountain in order to create the passageway you see there. And originally that passage, that the curve was much greater there. But it, when they first opened the canal, it was only 300 feet wide. Now it's over 750 feet wide in order to accommodate much larger ships. That was one of the changes. But even with that change, the size of the ships began to overwhelm the size of the canal. And this is an example of what I'm talking about. Passenger ships of this size, or, for instance, I saw the transit while I was in Panama of the USS New Jersey through the locks. When the USS New Jersey passed through the locks, it had 6 inches of clearance on either side. 6 inches. In this case, it was about 2 feet. But that's an extremely delicate passage. And when the number of ships began to be especially large, lots more engineering advances began to be important. The what was going on, to give you an example of the long-term trend, there are a couple of things you see here. First off, this is the average size in tonnage displacement of vessels at different moments in the history of the canal. 1955, 4,800 tons. 1975, 9,900 tons. 1995, 19,000 tons. 2014, almost 27,000 tons. You see that the size, the displacement of the vessels grew enormously over this period of time, but it really took off after 1975. That coincided with the container ship revolution, which, again, Dr. Boshkin is the expert on that. But here is a crucial turning point, which was not recognized at the time, by the way. It wasn't actually recognized until we got over here. But this crucial turning point in the mid-1970s is the point in which the tonnage, which is recognized in this yellow line, became greater than the number of transits of vessels. So this red line represents, and the record number of vessels was reached all the way back in 1965 when there were 15,000 transits. And you see that even to this day, actually this year, they're expecting about 15,000 transits again, and they've had 15,000 as recently as 2007. But in fact, this is the kind of high watermark in terms of the number of vessels. But look at what's happened to the tonnage, that is the displacement of the ships. Now, the U.S. policy for dealing with this process during our administration was we had a policy of one price for all. We, since our interest was keeping the cost of maritime transportation down, we simply had this simple policy of one toll for all the vessels. The Panamanians came along, and their model of corporate dynamism to take advantage of the canal and to use the canal to generate economic resources to support the development of their country, it became important for them to find a way to relate themselves to the shipping market and the advantage that their transportation provided to shippers. So as they looked at the situation, they looked at the different kinds of shipping that was growing up in the 70s and 80s. And one of the latest of the shipping developments had been the container revolution, which actually started in the late 1950s, early 1960s. And this line represents containers. Now, this only goes back to 1999, okay? So this is the period of Panamanian administration. But this is container ships. And you see that container ships are by far the most important customers of the canal. This line, this yellow line here, these are dry bulk ships, which and dry bulk cargo ships are very important to the United States because about 40% of all of the grain exports of the United States go through the Panama Canal to world markets. It's extremely important to our economy, and that's what goes in these dry bulk ships. And that historically had been the most important type of shipping through the canal. Then container ships, starting in 2001, suddenly overcame these dry bulk ships. But at the same time, there were these other lines of vessels that were becoming increasingly important. The Panamanians decided that they had to segment the market, and they had to change the structure of the tolls that they were charging in order to really relate the value of the transit service they were providing to the market conditions. As they segmented the market and changed the toll structure, the results of the change are really fascinating if you look at them right now. Because if you look at them right now, and sorry that this is hard to read, but really the most important thing is that this first bar up here is the revenue that comes from cargo ships. And that's almost half of the revenue generated by all the tolls of the canal. The other nine categories of vessels generate the other half of the toll revenue from the canal. So changing the structure of the tolls and the way in which the tolls were charged was extremely important. And it was also recognized by the shipping industry because it represented the relative prosperity of the shipping. As the container industry especially became more important, there was another part of the change that is important. When you see the labels, this label, PCUMS tonnage, that stands for Panama Canal Universal Measurement System, which was a system that was developed by the United States for relating the volume of cargo to the tonnage of vessels to have a universal system for the tolls that we charged ships. When we had only one system and we looked at vessels in only one way, that was a really simple system. But it turned out we were missing a lot because, for instance, the PCUMS system didn't consider at all what was above the deck of the ships. But now think about a container ship today and how much of the cargo of the container ship is actually above the deck. It turns out that for a typical container ship today, over half of the total volume that is carried by the vessel is above the deck. So if the old system didn't even measure the cargo that was carried above the deck, of course they weren't paying tolls for it either. So the Panamanians revised the system, and the result was that the cargo, the container ships, really started paying their share of the freight. And other adjustments have been made. And just to indicate how important this is, looking ahead, you see the nine categories that are here. There's one category that isn't here. That's right now, as the Panamanians are looking at what's happening in the world economy, they're saying, we're going to have another new category right around the corner. And that new category is going to be liquefied natural gas. And the reason why that's going to be so important to them and to the United States is because right now the United States is actually building four plants for liquefying natural gas, and there are eight other pending projects in the Gulf region that will, the calculation now by the Liquid Natural Gas Society is that there will be an average of between 5 and 8 post-Panamax size vessels each day departing from the U.S. Gulf Coast to East Asia that will require the use of the Panama Canal by 2020, which means that by 2020, liquefied natural gas will probably be up here in terms of the tolls they pay for the Panama Canal. So again, this is an indication of how important the Panamanian approach to corporate management is. Now, there is a lot more to the Panamanian concept of this corporate hub that they're creating, and it relates to the different elements of the cluster that is being created around the passageway. And I don't have time to go into a lot of detail, but one of the most important elements of the passageway are the ports. And here you see a picture of the port of MIT. That stands for the Manzanillo International Terminal that is in the Colon side, that is the Caribbean side of the Panama Canal. This photo reflects what the port was like at the time the Panamanian government accepted an offer by Seattle Stevedoring Services of America to convert this old seaplane tender port that was used by the U.S. Navy into a modern commercial port in 1996. At that time, there was only one crane in the port. And the entire complex of five sleepy little ports in Panama in that period of time moved 200,000 containers in all five of those ports clustered around the Panama Canal. To give you an idea of the total amount of commerce that was going on outside of the canal passageway itself. There were 15,000 ships going through the canal, but very few of them were stopping in Panama, and these ports were sleepy little ports, okay? So the Panamanians decided they had to create modern ports, and so this is what MIT looks like today. It's actually the most efficient port in the world today in terms of the speed with which they move containers. They're very proud of a Panamanian truck driver that they trained who won an international contest for moving containers 10 years later after he got his first driver's license. It's a fascinating story, and the development of this port is now moving about 3 million containers a year just in this port, and they have just announced a plan for adding another 2 million containers capacity. And this port, together with the other four sleepy ports, this year will move over 7 million containers. So 1996, the last year of the sleepy American style ports, were 200,000 containers. This year, under the Panamanian hub concept, over 7 million container movements in the five major ports of Panama. And at the same time, they have just signed, besides the expansion of the port of MIT, the Panama Ports Company's Balboa Port is adding another 1.5 million container capacity. The port operated by the Singapore Port Operating Company is going to add another 500,000 container capacity. And the Panamanian Canal Authority is going to build an entire new port on the Pacific side with 3 million container movement capacity. So all that is underway because of the dramatic hub-based concept the Panamanians are developing. Now, as I said, there's more to it, and one of the other things has been the development of intermodal transportation. And, of course, that's one of the keys. It isn't just the waterborne, but it's connecting to the waterborne to the seaborne. And with all of these changes and modernization projects, one of the fascinating experiences of the Panamanian administration right from the start is no longer have they carried out an expansion project, then they've reached another bottleneck. So, for instance, this is a photo that comes from 2004, right after a major expansion project had been completed and modernization was well underway, yet the growth in traffic and the size of the vessels and the need to maintain one of the two locks required a backup of ships. And so these bottlenecks and the experience of these bottlenecks convinced the Panamanians that they actually needed to create an entire new passageway, what they call a third set of locks. This led the country to spend 2 years studying the approach that they should take. And there was a huge national debate. After the comprehensive expansion plan was developed, they spent a year having a national debate over whether or not they should carry out the expansion plan and if it was too ambitious and they were trying to do too much, or if it wasn't ambitious enough. Because, in fact, they decided that there were some ships that were so big they weren't even going to build the canal for the biggest ships on the horizon, but they were going to build the canal so it would continue to be a major source of revenue for the country and be economically efficient. The national debate, there were times in which it appeared as though the country might not endorse the expansion plan. And a lot of the leaders of the original transition even opposed, and they were concerned about corruption, they were concerned about institutional development. But in the end, the vote was overwhelming, and more than three-quarters of the country voted in favor in a national referendum in October of 2006 for the expansion plan that is underway today. The actual expansion plan didn't start until 2007, and here's a diagram which just gives you an idea of the dimensions of the change that are underway. This is what the old locks were like, and you can see the largest size, Panamax-sized vessel there. This is a post-Panamax vessel. So the maximum number of containers that this vessel could handle is 4,400 containers, whereas this vessel will be able to handle up to 14,000 containers. So it's much larger, and the locks, the dimensions of this change are enormous. I wish I had time to go into more detail and give you some ideas, but here's a way in which you can get an artist's conception of the dimensions of the change. This is the old Pedro Miguel locks, and you see the size of the locks in the vessel here, and then you see a post-Panamax size ship over here, and you see how it would be impossible for that ship to pass through these locks. That's just part of the image, but the other side, part of this that just fascinates me is these gates. These gates are so enormous that when the gates slide back and forth and let the water in and out of these locks now, it will be like moving an 11-story building back and forth. They're actually even 33 feet wide. Now, the old locks are a marvel, and any of you who have seen the canal operate know how fascinating it is to see those gates open. But the current gates are 7 feet wide and 82 feet high. These locks are 110 feet high and 33 feet wide, just to give you an idea of the dimensions of the change. And there are a lot. One of the things that's really important to the Panamanians is to be true to their engineering excellence commitment. There are a lot of innovative elements of the design, some of them which were developed by U.S. engineering firms, two important U.S. engineering firms and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers helped in the design stages of the project. One of the most innovative parts of the design of the new canal is a water-saving recycling system. So they're going to have these new locks that are more than twice the size of the old locks, but they're going to use less water. The new locks will require only 52 million gallons for each ship that goes through, whereas the old locks required 55 million gallons. Now, with all of that, the Panamanians are still looking at many elements of building out their hub. And one of the most important relates to us. It was just announced last week that San Francisco will become the 33rd international city directly connected to the new air hub that's being created in Panama. And the Panamanians announced a couple of months ago, when President Obama was in Panama for the Summit of the Americas, at which Mike was present, that the largest contract in the Western Hemisphere for aircraft sales was the contract of Copa Airlines of Panama, in which they spent $6.6 billion to acquire 61 new Boeing aircraft. That's part of the hub expansion process. And keeping the canal up to date is especially important to us. And in fact, I didn't realize until I saw a presentation that the administrator of the Canal Authority just recently did in Washington, D.C., that he used a new statistic, which I didn't know. And it actually shows right here, 69% of all of the cargo transiting the canal is either going to or coming from a U.S. port. The fascinating thing about that number, did you recognize how important it was, Mike? The fascinating thing is that when we turned the canal over to the Panamanians, that number was 62%. So the canal has actually become more important to the U.S. economy under Panamanian administration than it was under the United States. And actually, the percentage of total transits going to or coming from the United States had been declining for over a decade when the transition took place. That's just part of the changes and adjustments that are going on. But last and most important, and I'm sorry, I apologize for the amount of time I've taken, but it's the institutional modernization that is going on with this mania the Panamanians in some ways have inherited from us. That is, they in some ways, they interpret the advance of their society through its technological developments and their engineering wonders, just as we do. And here you see examples of it. Panama City has, of the 40 tallest buildings in the Western Hemisphere, below the Rio Grande, 21 of them are in Panama City. There are actually several buildings in Panama City now from which you can see both oceans, which is really remarkable. It looks like the skyline of Miami or New York City, rather than a Latin American country. And of course, they've just added a metro system to Panama City, and there are lots of other technological wonders going on. But like us, they're challenged in keeping up with the institutional infrastructure they need to keep those technological wonders in place and working to serve all the people. Now, let me turn it over to Mike, because there are some strategic issues, especially related to our interests in California, that are that he's going to address. Herman.
We've been going for well over an hour, and I'd like to have you stand up and stretch for a moment.
I'm sorry.
How many here have been to Panama?
Through
the canal? Yeah, they,
yeah, okay.
It probably has a little pointer light, too.
We couldn't find one.
Oh, okay. It looks like it should be, but there isn't. I had one, but the battery doesn't. Okay, I'm running cleanup today, so bear with me. I'm not what you would call an expert on Panama Canal. My major focus is on global economics and transportation, and so the logical place for me is with ships and shipping routes and things of that nature, including containers. So just a word on a focus here for me. I will be looking at mostly traffic routes of economic globalization and spend virtually no time on military operations, although military operations are obviously significant to the canal as well. Second thing is that I will be concentrating on mostly containers. There's a little data that I have beyond that, but not on dry bulk or oil and chemicals, which are a whole other category, as we found indicated a moment ago. With regard to containers, one of the things I think very few people realize is the massive amount of increase in foreign trade generally, but even more so within waterborne commerce of containers. And you can attribute that effectively to the globalization movement that we've had over the years. These only go back to 1970, which is the very early period of globalization, also the very early period of what is called the container revolution. And in starting out this discussion, I'm trying to get across the notion that there's been a huge magnitude of change here that people have incrementally been aware of, but when you step back and look at 40 years of change, it's actually quite phenomenal to recognize. I would also argue here that globalization has really not yet met its full potential. That is to say that trade routes are still today mostly regional, with trading partners proximal to one another. And one of the best examples of that is our own trading partners in the United States. If you look at this slide, for example, you see that the single largest category of trade is actually within North America, that is Canada and Mexico. And that while a lot of people think China is everything to us, China is a distant second when it comes to the trade regionally. I could have done a slide on China. You would have seen exactly the same sort of distribution. China relies much more heavily in trade around the Asian continent than it does anywhere else, and then trails off from there. So I think it's important also to realize at the outset here that we're dealing not with the full potential. And if you look at the previous slide, which I just showed, with where you get a huge increase over the last 40 years, just imagine as globalization moves forward and becomes more evenly distributed than it already is throughout the world, what that potential means. The way I look at the role of globalization to the Panama Canal is through what I call five determinants. Now, there's probably six or seven or ten, but I'm restricted to probably a few minutes here as opposed to a few hours to get my points across. But I think these are probably the five most important ones at any rate. The first one has to do with route destinations regarding, as they relate to the consumption that's done throughout the world. If you look in the period prior to globalization and containerization, you found that world consumption was mostly concentrated in what might be called the North Atlantic. That is, the United States, realizing that most of the population today in the United States is still east of the Mississippi, and Europe. And they, in combination, in the 1980s, only constituted about 20% of the world population. So, in effect, we see 80% of consumption done by 20% of the population. That's changed dramatically. Since 1980, for example, world consumption is now more distributed throughout the world. And since 2000, China, of course, has become a major consumer. We think of China often as the producer of goods and services throughout the world, but they're now as it turns out, I think this year or late last year became the world's largest consumer of goods and services worldwide. And since 1910, we're beginning to see some movement in the Southern Hemisphere. Most of us, when we think about globalization and worldwide phenomena, we don't really think of the Southern Hemisphere. There's sort of a blind spot in our thinking. And they are now beginning to become relevant here. Australia is an example of that. Brazil, certainly, for those of you who might be Latin American scholars. The result is, to me, rather significant. If we look at merchandise trade throughout the world, of course, the Northern Hemisphere phenomenon is still very present, isn't it? And this is very current. I think it's 2013 is the date of these figures. But it's certainly spread out in the Northern Hemisphere, where it used to be North Atlantic. We're now seeing Russia and, of course, China and Japan becoming very significant players in the total trade of the world as consumers. And then we see some evidence of movement in the Southern Hemisphere, particularly Brazil and Australia and other areas of Oceania. The second major issue relating to how trade routes are organized or distributed has to do with the production capacity worldwide. If we look at the period 1950 to 1980, production capacity is heavily concentrated in what is called the Tropic of Cancer, North Pacific. Corner, and most of us, I remember when we were kids, we always thought everything that we consumed came from Japan or, in some cases, South Korea or Taiwan. But subsequent to that, the period specifically 1980 to 2000, that locus has shifted to the South China Sea, particularly Singapore, Thailand, Philippines, the Malaysian Peninsula, and Vietnam. And with Singapore as sort of the gatekeeper of that whole region. And then more recently, since 2000, we begin to see a further movement of the locus of production capacity to mainland China and to India. And the purpose in looking at a map like this is to suggest or to see the realization that the canal traffic is reflecting shifts in production locations. And that's one of the points that I'm going to show you now as we move forward with the relevance of the canal. So, for example, if you compare Suez versus Panama, again, this is recent data. I don't remember where. I think it's 2014. Is it? Yeah, 2014. It shows up there. And I'm not sure why the top of the slide isn't showing at the moment, but it's supposed to. You find that this is containerization on the left and everything else on the right. And everything else on the right is not just dry bulk and oil. It also includes cruise ships and things like that. The biggest component for either canal is containerization. But if you compare containerization of Panama versus that of Suez, it's about half the size of Suez. Now, what's the reason for that? Well, let me go back one slide. As production slides from the old northern area of the Pacific down into the South China Sea and then over into the Bay of Bengal, what you find is that all the traffic is moving through the straits here at Singapore and moving up through Suez, to feed the North Atlantic consumption, that is the eastern United States and Europe. So that's an important determinant in my judgment. Another determinant is the criteria for selecting optimal routes that is done by the shippers themselves. And just a footnote on this determinant, there are approximately 15 container shipping firms throughout the world, but they are organized into two major consortiums. And so effectively what we have is an oligopoly of shipping, where there are lots and lots of very small fries still around. Believe it or not, there's still a few what are called break bulkers out there that have to take their goods off and on board by nets as opposed to containers. They're mostly local ships. They're not essentially engaged in globalization, but there are a few of those around. Most of these shippers are the large shippers, involved in the two major consortiums, account for 35% of all the east-west traffic going between various locations in the northern hemisphere. And I want you to keep that in mind when we talk here next about what criteria they use in selecting their optimal routes. There are about five major considerations. The first one is cost per unit, as you might expect. And they're with their shipping decisions, they're specifically focused on the transportation component of that cost per unit. A second and equally important one over time has been the time in transit through the intermodal system, and I'll talk a little bit more about the intermodal system in a moment. But there are vast differences in the amount of time it takes to get from a production site to a consumption site using both land and sea routes in the process. On top of this, there's a third element. Again, they all sort of relate back to cost, and that's what's called in the industry the one-stop transshipment preference, where the idea comes from a load center concept. The ships would like to be able to unload at one location and offload in one location. That is by no means traditional historically. In the old days, even in the early container revolution, you know, they'd come across from Tokyo and they'd stop in Seattle and then they'd stop in Oakland and then they'd stop in Long Beach and maybe someplace else along the way, dropping off a few containers here and a few containers there. But the profitability of all of that shifted, and the container seaports accommodated that by themselves getting bigger and bigger and bigger in size, where a lot of the smaller fries didn't have the investment to make in modernization dropped out of the scene. The perfect example is San Francisco. They were the earliest dropout, as a matter of fact, and everything moved over to Oakland. And traditionally, you know, San Francisco was the seaport. I mean, imagine all the stories and the songs written about the San Francisco seaport and all that. It that's changed dramatically over time. The related to that, we can see a number of things associated. The access to large scale port technologies, those have dramatically changed. Going to mention that in a moment. Access to transcontinental rail routes, or what is sometimes called the land bridge phenomenon. And access to advanced producer services, namely, it's not by accident that most major load center containerized seaports are located in global cities. The San Francisco Bay Area is a global city. New York, New Jersey is. L.A., Long Beach is. And so on down the line. And the reason for that is that most of these shippers utilize their transshipment opportunity to move things off a ship onto land as an ideal place to locate the consortium of business services, legal services, marketing services, logistics services, et cetera, and they like to agglomerate then in global cities. So that phenomenon is present as well. And the last element here is what is called in the business lingo just-in-time management, or what some people refer to as inventory on wheels model. If you've noticed, in most major cities today, we don't have warehouses anymore, or if we do, they've been converted to condos. But that's used to be where we kept the slack, if you will, in the traffic of goods throughout the world. Now the ships themselves are the warehouses, and so that's those are the biggies in terms of what the shippers are thinking and pressurizing the system to do. A fourth element here is what I'm referring to, and the term has already been thrown around, a post-Panamax era that is since about the late 1970s, you found a literal proliferation of alternative routes, both land and sea. And so, for example, you can see this almost in different eras. Since the 1970s, the trans-Pacific trade through the North American land bridge, I'm going to show you something on that in a second. Since 1980, the Suez Canal emerges as a major route as production moves from the south, from the northern Pacific, excuse me, to the South China Sea and westward. And since 1910, there's now even more experiments. You may or may not have heard of the Trans-Siberian Land Bridge. Show you something in that momentarily. And then, of course, global warming has allowed last year the first containerized ship moving, transiting across the Arctic on its passage from the Asian continent to the United States and other places on the Pacific. And, of course, then in 2016, the new Panama Canal opens. So, again, giving in another aspect to the notion of alternatives. And we can see this in a number of slides or representations. This is what is called the North American Land Bridge. And since about probably early 1970s, we find that a lot of shippers decide that in conjunction with railroads, seaports on the West Coast could do as good a job as going through the Panama Canal. And what they meant by that is not just delivering goods to the United States east of the Mississippi River, but delivering them on to Europe. So what you found is that a lot of shippers forewent the Panama Canal and dropped off goods in Seattle, Oakland, Long Beach, and L.A., where they were put on trains and bused across the United States, put back on ships in New York, principally New York, New Jersey, bound for Europe, or other parts of the North Atlantic. And that's what's called the North American Land Bridge. Now, because of Suez and the movement of production more to the South China Sea area, you find that the land bridge has diminished in its relevance over time. It's diminished for another reason, too. I don't know. Anybody in here railroad people? I hope not, because I don't have any good words to say about the railroad industry. The railroad industry is the principal reason behind the failure of the land bridge, at least in North America. They categorically refuse to invest anything. And in fact, you know that you've all been to Norton near the summit of Tahoe? You know where I'm speaking? Where Sugar Bowl is? Yeah. If you've never looked there, it's just off of Interstate 80. Take a look sometime. You'll find that the first tunnel, which you can see from the ski resort there, has a groove right down the middle of it. And it's about 10 feet wide. The reason is, of course, containers are 8 feet wide. But when the shippers wanted faster movement in larger volume, they went to what is called a double stack system, another thing the railroads refused to invest in. And so Port of Oakland had to pay for that groove, even though it was a railroad responsibility. The shippers, because of the residents of the railroads, also are the ones who had to invest in the double stacks. That is, they had to build and invest in their own cars, even though they were running down the railroads of the Union Pacific, Southern Pacific in those days, and the Burlington Northern. It was their investment. It's not by accident then that you frequently see the name of the shipper on that flatbed car that is carrying the container, and not the railroad who is carrying that container. So part of the problem which diminished the relevance of West Coast in this massive routing of goods around the world has to do with the railroads and a lot less to do with other considerations. In addition to that, the Suez is an alternative route in blue, of course, on the lower part there. And in conjunction with that, I mentioned the Trans-Siberian Railroad. Some people are referring to that as the New Silk Road. That is still in concept form. The Chinese are the principal backers behind this. They have run trains across there. Look like a simple task, right? Except the problem is that when you run across places like Mongolia for almost 9 months out of the year, you're dealing with permafrost. Although what's making it more viable is, again, global warming. And that could take a lot of steam out of the sails for shippers if they can get a lot of their goods directly across the continent to Europe and then maybe onto ships to the U.S. if they need to go that way. And, of course, the northern blue is the new Arctic route, which is represented here in comparison to both the Suez and the Panama Canal, the northern passage, as it's sometimes referred to. There's actually two passages up there. The more viable one is near Russia. The second one is the one that's officially called the Old Northwest Passage on the Canadian side of the Arctic. Now, if you look at what all this has meant to shipping routes and so forth, concentrate on this slide for a moment, results really in a worldwide combination of what is called the multimodal system. The black, ink black areas are the continents. And the other areas are the shipping routes. The darker the red or the whiter the red, the more intense the route is worldwide. And Panama, of course, is over here on the left.
Traffic coming in here on the west coast, and then the heavy traffic going back out. And it goes both ways, by the way. I don't mean to suggest it's a one-way street here. And then notice the Suez Canal areas coming out of the South China Sea area, moving through the isthmus here near Singapore, and moving through the canal.
It gives you sort of a visual of how these sort of sort out in terms of concentration over time. The last determinant that I would propose is significant to talk about here is the infrastructure technology addressing the scale and intermodal system control that occurs, and a lot of people don't see, obviously. The first one of these is the containers themselves. It's since the 1960s, the containers have grown in length, not height or width. Those have stayed standard, and for one principal reason, by the way, and that's the land bridge, the old land bridge. You can't go down a roadway with chassis wider than 8 feet, nor, well, we've hedged that a bit, but it used to be had to be 8 feet tall too. But the real push has become to make them longer. So we start out with 20-foot units, and that's why you've seen the term in the newspapers and so forth, TEUs. TEU is a 20-foot equivalent unit. So all containers are measured according to those original 20-foot containers, even though they've been replaced for the most part. I haven't seen a 20-footer in a long time. By a succession of lengths, first 40s, 48s, 52s, and in the last couple of years, you've seen 53-foot containers going down the roadways. The ships have also been subject, as we saw earlier mentioned, in terms of technologies. The most obvious is the absolute size of these things. Now, if you look back in the early period, the dates are up there on the slide, the 1960s, 1970s, you're dealing with ships that are a fraction of the length of the ships today. And the best way to visualize that is to think of how many containers these things were holding. And in that period, what is called the A period and even the B period, you're talking about roughly 1,000 containers plus or minus a couple hundred depending upon the size of the ship. The new containers today, what is called the Triple E post-Panamax ship, can take, and I've seen different figures, anywhere from 18,000 to 20,000 containers. What's the magnitude between 1,000 and 20,000? Pretty big number, right, in terms of exponential increase over time. And that's over that 40-year period that you're seeing. And, of course, they're stacking them deeper because they can make the ships deeper. So they've got more levels of containers going up. It speaks to the issue a moment ago about how Panama discovered, hey, we're letting stuff go through that isn't getting taxed here because it's above deck. Well, they figured out that they could also do lots of other things in terms of not just stacking them higher above deck, but also going deeper in the water with them as well. There was a symbiotic relationship that you see between the seaports and the ship scale, where effectively the cranes that were designed evolved with the ship and the volume. And so there's been generations. And that's an important factor because so many seaports have dropped out of the ball game because they can't make the reinvestment that it takes every time. And most of these seaports, by the way, are publicly owned, public enterprises as they're called. A city owns them or they're a special district or something of that nature. New York, New Jersey is a joint public enterprise owned by the state of New York and the state of New Jersey. And this is the old model, I should say. Ships come off with the container trains, container cranes. They're moved by essentially forklifts, only you might not recognize them as such, and moved to a stacking area, and then manually people move them from a stacking area either onto trucks or onto rail cars. The significance of this is that China, being the leader in the new technologies dock side, have invested heavily in robotics. And so they are rapidly becoming the most efficient ports and the largest because they can move things so much faster. And if you look at the ports that Tianjin, Dalian, Singapore, Shanghai, and you've seen their ports recently, it's amazing how they picked up the ball in terms of technological innovation in that area. I mentioned the double stack trains a moment ago. That's another issue. And, of course, the new Panama Canal, which is going to provide access to all post-Panamax ships in the world. Now, the last thing that I would propose before I hit my concluding slide is that what we are experiencing momentarily, at least, is a multimodal system that's badly out of balance. And I've mentioned the major ingredients for this already, but if you look, for example, at the load center demand that goes through major seaports worldwide, but most particularly in the United States, they've been subjected to some interesting phenomena. Number one, as more and more ships, seaports dropped out of the ball game, the competition, what we find is that, yes, there's larger seaports, but there's also fewer of them. So, in effect, you might think of that as a bottleneck getting narrower. And the effect of that, we saw that in Oakland. We also saw it in L.A. in the recent strike. Two seaports alone could basically halt the global trade that is coming into the United States. And as you saw, I think this last week, the new statistics out, at least the government officials are saying that the blame for the decline in world trade was due to those strikes that were occurring at those seaports. Now, the other side of that, it's not only fewer seaports, but those seaports that are left, all strikes aside, are causing more and more congestion and delays. The labor unions, in effect, are what we would probably call a short-term phenomenon. The strike's over, you get back to normal business. But what I'm talking about is the longer-term issues that are causing congestion, delay, and higher shipping costs. With fewer ports, what you're finding is that there are more things that can hold up the train, so to speak. And while many of us would like to blame the labor unions for all these bad things that are occurring, fact is the railroads are the bigger part of the problem long term. With their consolidations, remember we used to have a Southern Pacific here, now we have the Union Pacific, which consolidated with the Southern Pacific. Burlington Northern did likewise in the northern part. And in effect, they have got a very significant oligopoly that they've engaged in, which we all know as creates different behavioral patterns and different preferences in decision making. And what they did mainly was close routes. If you look from north to south, all of the east-west routes, one right after another from Canada to Mexico, have dropped over the last 20 years by about half the routes that they used to be present. So they no longer have alternatives. If there's a slide, or if the snow's closed a railroad, or there's some action at one of the locations going east, you don't have an alternative anymore for containers. The other piece that I would throw into the mix here regarding these phenomena is the problem that is accentuated for both of the canals. I didn't mention before, but with the land bridge, if it works like it's supposed to 100% of the time, it's the quickest way to get from Asia to the East Coast of the United States or Europe. If you look at a ship leaving Singapore, going the conventional route across the Pacific to, I think that's got Long Beach listed up there, it could be Oakland or Seattle for that matter, it takes about 12 days to get there. In the ideal model, which has periodically worked and not worked, putting containers on ships bound for Europe took another 5 days. Now do the math. It takes 32 days to go through the Suez to come from essentially the same location. It takes 25 days if you go through the Panama Canal. The problem is that because of the railroads and other things intervening in that, that isn't, the land bridge is not very reliable that you can get your goods on time sometimes and not on others. And remember, one of the criteria of the shippers was time in transit. So this becomes a dicey issue for a lot of the shippers in continuing to use the West Coast seaports and the North American land bridge. That leaves me with my concluding remarks. This is about the Panama Canal, and so my task is to speculate about the Panama's prospects in a global context, and my conclusion on that is that it hinges on about four major things, most of which I've mentioned. One of these is how the route origin, namely where the production sites in the world are, and the destination site, namely for consumption, further evolve worldwide. What happens, for example, if the Southern Hemisphere gets engaged and becomes a major consumption and or production location in globalization? Second idea has to do with the shipping firms themselves. They could easily alter their corporate interest calculations. As was discussed here by all of us, they've moved to bigger and bigger ships, and they're now using the triple E size ship, which is over a quarter mile in length, if you can imagine that. But are those going to be economical? And the evidence isn't really very strong in that regard. These shippers went to oil tankers about a decade or so ago, bigger and bigger and bigger, and found that there's a trade-off to be had. The trade-off is you can certainly get your cost per unit down dramatically, but on the other hand, when there's a recession, those ships are sitting idle, and they're all based upon the investment made and the interest that has to be paid on those ships, whether or not those ships are moving or not. And so the speculation, in fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, I have a copy of it with me here, just this last week, making that very point that it is questionable that these huge new ships will in fact become economically viable over the long run. They require a sort of stable average growth year in and year out to make a dollar. You know, I'm not talking about 2008 crash. I'm talking about your normal cycles that occur when you have ships with nothing to do for sometimes up to 18 months. 18 months is the average recession period since the Great Depression. And the third area is how implementation of the alternative trade routes unfold. That is the Arctic going to be viable, or is this just a pipe dream? Trans-Siberian land bridge going to turn out? And ultimately, how are the shippers in particular going to receive the new technologies that will create the new Panama Canal? And The last area has to do with the technologies in the multimodal route system. So I will leave it at that. Oh, I do have one more slide, which you may or may not have ever seen. And the reason I show this is that they say the Panama Canal opened in 1914. But this comes from the Smithsonian. And it's an original, poster, I guess, is what it was. And it shows the KISS, which is the two oceans coming together through the Panama Canal, as dating to 1915. So we have an historian on board here, and he may want to comment as to what's the discrepancy here in 2014, 2015, or 1920, I should say, in the various times when Panama was recognized as part of the system.
Thank you, gentlemen, and thank you all for your patience. I think Norma just told me this was billed as an hour presentation, so we're going in. I know we're going into extra innings or overtime. So that poster was for the, and you can see it at a historical society if you'd like. Of course, it was done for the fair, and fair promoters and boosters generally play pretty loosely with dates. Okay, so we have a lot of different questions, and I may even have some more out there, and I'll try and both answer some as well as shape some together. Any number of people asked about the Nicaraguan Canal and its prospects and what that might do to change both the Panamanian Canal and, of course, especially after Herman's presentation, kind of the global globalization of shipping. So anybody want to tackle Nicaragua real quick for me?
Gene.
Gene, go. Okay, good. 38 seconds.
The short answer is that the Nicaraguan Canal route is 178 miles. That is more than 125 miles longer than the Panama route. It is also complicated because it would use this huge natural lake, Lake Nicaragua, and most environmentalists believe it would be an environmental disaster. There's also a huge water shortage in Nicaragua, and so the preliminary cost calculations for building a canal across Nicaragua are that it would cost at least $60 billion, which is more than 10 times the cost of the canal Panama expansion. So the likelihood of a Nicaragua canal is very limited.
Good answer. So good luck to Nicaragua.
Can I add one thing to that?
Quickly, because I've got literally stacks of questions.
There's also a political dimension here, and that is to do that probably requires great involvement by the Chinese. And there's actually two proposals for the Nicaraguan Canal, but the Chinese have sort of taken a step back because of the huge sum of money involved in doing that and for other kinds of reasons. So there is...
there's a lot of geopolitics, involved, absolutely. Let's take us back to 1903. We had a couple of questions kind of both on the original relationship with the United States and the hatched nation, if you will, of Panama. And so I think maybe just to clarify the original relationship, one of our... audience members ask, was it a little more like the British in Hong Kong? Was it, obviously it had a number of treaties. But maybe just to clarify some of those origin stories for us, probably Mike. Yeah.
Yes, the United States really had concentrated on expanding across the North America and didn't really develop colonies in other parts of the world until the Cuban Spanish-American War of 1898.
Sure.
And that's when having overseas territories, having that canal, having the east and west coast needing to be connected by ocean, made the Panama route absolutely essential for the standpoint of Teddy Roosevelt and the people in his government.
Right. While you're on that, Mike, I had a couple questions about TR himself, mm-hmm. in terms of what do you think is now, well over 100 years later, is kind of, is his legacy, and both kind of how do we look back on him? Imperialist, you know, big stick wielding imperialist, where do you end up on him?
Well, we kind of accept TR as he was. He was very, very willful, very forward, mm-hmm. very aggressive, and yet he was a reformer. I can really just recommend that you see the Roosevelts, the television program that begins with Teddy and moves on through.
How that Ken Burns did.
And I think that's a very balanced treatment of TR.
Yeah, there's some fabulous books on TR. The audience member asked it very well, enlightened futurist or imperial despot. I would actually say probably both, as well as a remarkable environmentalist in many respects, and a recovering asthmatic who found his place in the West. Okay, Nicaragua, we got global warming came up in a number of your questions. Thank you. And I think we certainly heard Herman talk about its impacts, whether it be on permafrost, Northwest Passage, reemergence, which I think is astounding if that happens in our lifetimes, which it probably will for some of us. But what about direct impacts on the canal itself of global warming? And I'm guessing the Panamanians are trying to take that into consideration as they proceed with their 2016 work.
Actually, one of the areas in which the Panamanians have been very concerned, and this is a concern that developed in the transition process with great support. Actually, some of the most forward support from the United States Agency for International Development related to studying the watershed condition and long-term viability of the watershed and watershed management. And they developed a long-range program for protection and expansion of the watershed. It's one of the reasons why in which the model for the expansion decided to utilize a recycling, water-saving approach to the expansion project rather than an expansion of the water supply, which is something that actually they've planned for in the future. But the important thing is that the Panamanians have developed this system very closely with the global community, mm-hmm. and they have actually succeeded in improving the watershed over the last 20 years. And this is fascinating because this is just the reverse of what's happened in Nicaragua, where the watershed continues to deteriorate. And so,
interesting. Yeah, great.
Can I add one other thing?
Sure.
I think one of the big effects that on the canal is going to be what global warming is doing to crop management throughout the world. That is,
on the supply side. Yeah.
Yeah, as the growing areas of the world go further and further north, that may shift. You know, production sites is the term that I used in my slides,
sure.
which may change the dynamic.
Great, thank you. Good, nice answers combined. Two interesting ones on kind of perhaps if I can combine them, U.S. both foreign policy as well as environmental and international relations. One of our audience members asked, was the neglect of the infrastructure and environment kind of representative of what became a relatively short-sighted approach to infrastructure in general? Kind of, I think the question, which is an interesting one, is it kind of parallel what happened post, let's say, 1960s or so, 1970s, with our own infrastructure? And then if you can maybe combine an answer, and you probably tag team this one, looking to the future, what changes do you think the United States government should make to our foreign policy philosophies regarding international commerce and relations? Those are two big ones. So maybe let's just take kind of the infrastructure question. And you very well articulated that with railroads. We could talk about that with highways, et cetera, or our mass transit. But did the canal get kind of caught up in that? Or
Actually, it's a little bit
military.
It's related also to what I call the national enterprise and the extent to which the canal has fought to be considered a national enterprise of Panama, and so part of their approach is to protect the development of infrastructure, and so one of the needs they see, for instance, is port expansion, which private investors and the government haven't been doing. So it's a little bit like the neglect of the railroads in the United States. Right. So the Panama Canal Authority sees its responsibility for protecting that interest of the passage and the development of the hub. And so in a sense, they're doing for the transit and the passage for the entire country something that isn't being done in the United States because there isn't a way of protecting the total quality of the infrastructure.
And dear, while you're on that, one interesting, I think, question you guys should probably answer very quickly is current revenue streams that the Panamanians receive from the canal. Do you have a sense of total revenue?
Sure. Right now, the canal is providing Panama just about $1 billion a year in net revenue to the government. The largest amount of revenue ever provided by the United States was $138 million. The Panamanians in the first 6 years of management, paid the government of Panama about the same the United States paid the government of Panama in 86 years.
So there has
been a dramatic change, in the revenue production capacity of the canal, and the Panamanians, manage it as a commercial enterprise, and they regard its success in maintaining that revenue stream for their country.
Right. No, I thought that was fascinating, the ways in which the Panamanians have really made the canal their own. And then I think since this is the international forum, let's end with some thoughts on potential changes that the United States should make to its policies relating to commerce. Dr. Economist, that might be you. Yeah.
Well, only partially me.
But I think the
starting point of that kind of a discussion, because it can go on a long time, and a lot of it is speculation, has to do with whether we're going to sign a new trade pact with Asian countries. And that there's a lot of geopolitics involved in that. China wants to corral CETO and make it its little fiefdom with various satellites. And I think one of the major things underlying the Obama negotiations has to do with, can we prevent that from happening? And is this the way to do it? So in terms of the impact on Panama, I think it depends very much on whether the Chinese win this one or whether we win it or default on it. I don't have a particular position on that, but
yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Yeah. Any other thoughts before we close? And I get to hit the gavel. I get to hit the gavel, or do you get to hit the gavel? Oh, you get to. Norma hits the gavel.
Can I just chime in one point, which I think is fascinating, and it relates to this decision that I mentioned earlier. The decision of Copa Airlines to start direct flights to San Francisco. When they announced this development, which will start in September, and it will be daily flights from San Francisco to Tocumen International, they were very clear in recognizing that this is part of adding to the efficiency of the connection in the Americas to the Asian area and the Asian arena. And so Panama is actually very determined to help the United States be a more efficient global player. And the Panamanians have been pushing in terms of development of international pacts to move the United States along. And so Panama clearly sees that their future is invested in making sure that the United States remains a dynamic player in global commerce. And
our thanks to Gene Bigler, international consultant and former U.S. diplomat, to Michael Conniff, Professor of History at San Jose State University, Herman Boschkin, Professor Emeritus, College of Business, San Jose State University, and our moderator, Anthea Hartig, CEO and Executive Director of the California Historical Society. We also thank our audience, particularly for your good questions. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California in its 113th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.
Thank you for being here.